obviously.
Thank you.
Looking forward to this. Let's start off with, and I don't want to torpedo the entire conversation and start off with a bit of a Debbie Downer-esque.
That made fake news look kind of fun. It's a bit Debbie Downer.
But before we start talking about fake news, I feel like the term is thrown around a lot. And sometimes it's employed in a way where we're not actually necessarily referring to fake news itself. So I feel like the way we talk about fake news is important as well. And, you know, we have this stage and all these people and their captive attention, you know, rapt listening to all of us. So you guys, prior to, you know, when we were chatting before this, we're talking about a study in which the way we talk about fake news can in fact be a little bit problematic.
Yeah, well, I mean, we wanted to talk about the science of how fake news kind of hijacks our brains as the animals that we are. And there's something that we don't deal well with, which is cognitive dissonance. We believe things, we've grown up and we feel a certain way. And a lot of what fake news does is it encapsulates what you already believe in, and it tells you something and then you agree with it. And when we were doing research from January 2019, that's hopefully a recent enough date, okay? I'm listening. They actually found that fake news in the 2016 election ended up being a lot less of a big deal than what people had actually thought that it was. We are all here to talk about how fake news is something that we should be very concerned about. But this study actually kind of went against that. And that is a cognitive dissonance that I felt as I read it. I was like, wait, that can't be true. And that maybe is something you're understanding now. But yeah, they found that people who were actually sharing, this was on Facebook, it was a study, people who were sharing on Facebook who actually shared news regularly were not sharing that much fake news. And it was actually not as big a deal as we actually thought and the media might have thought. And I know we're all here talking about it, but I just want you to understand that that's like the type of feeling that we are going to be talking about when we start to explain how fake news actually works, like neurologically, and why we as animals can be very susceptible to it.
Nothing to add?
No, that was great.
Okay.
Good start.
So you mentioned something, cognitive dissonance there. So I feel like cognitive dissonance kind of goes hand in hand with its buddy confirmation bias. A lot of the time. You want to just explain those two terms to our audience?
Sure. Well, I mean, cognitive dissonance is a lot of like when you have information coming in and it disagrees with something that you already believe. And so as a result, it's difficult for you to, you start to rationalize your own belief around cognitive dissonance. And confirmation bias is obviously when we're driving down the highway, we might say like, this lane is so much slower. I keep seeing these cars passing me. And that confirmation bias is that you're actually only acknowledging when cars are going faster than you and never really looking back behind and noticing that sometimes they're actually falling behind you. It's only in the moments that you're paying attention, suddenly you're confirming your own belief as opposed to actually looking at the facts is that usually lanes like go ebb and flow. And as a result, you're probably moving just as fast as the other lanes. So confirmation bias, it happens to all of us. We're constantly looking for ways, especially when it comes to politics, to find things that we already believe and then find results and evidence and research to support those things. So it's just important to be aware that, yeah, we might have been told that fake news was this huge deal that absolutely wrecked the American election as an example. And I'm sure it had an impact. But it's important for us to say, like, hey, we have to acknowledge these studies that exist that contradict my own opinions so that I'm not just using the things that support them.
And when we're talking about a certain level of confirmation bias, is it that we as, you know, essentially primates go out and actively seek that little neurotransmitter rush that we get by seeing something that already, you know, kind of confirms what we already believe, irrespective of whether or not it's true?
Yes, it's true. So especially even like social media and something that we use all the time, it's very devoid of nuance. And the thing especially, so our job is that we are science communicators. So we take scientific information and we try and make it interesting to as many people as possible. So that's a really interesting thing to be talking about right now, because essentially what we have to do is take valid information and try and make it interesting. And so what we are well aware of is how challenging that is, because science is extremely nuanced, and very often we're making and writing scripts and we're wanting this narrative and it can't come together. And it's kind of interesting, because if you watch our videos, one thing that we have learned is that if you make a really catchy thumbnail and a catchy title, people will click on it. And so that's what we do, and we actually utilize that. But a lot of people eventually tell us there's sometimes a frustration, because they're like, well, then we watch this video and it's actually very nuanced. You don't give me the answer. And we're like, yeah, we're sorry. That's the way that the world works. But when it comes to confirmation bias, another thing that is interesting sort of to link it to us as animals is that we actually because we are such a cooperative species, that's why we are here today in this beautifully designed building. We rely so often on other people's miraculous intellect, and we just take a lot of things for granted. And that's why, as a species, we are so fascinating and phenomenal. But what is really quite surprising is how little we actually know about how everything works. Like, how did that light turn on? You tell me. Okay. And so they've done lots of studies. Like, healthcare is a great example because that's sort of linked to the election. They'll ask people about their stance on healthcare, and they will get very emotional responses. And like you were saying, it does feel good to feel intelligent to have that answer. And then they'll follow it up by saying, okay, now explain to us how healthcare works in your country. And they'll struggle to explain it, and then they'll re-ask them again, I want to ask you your stance on healthcare, and then they'll change the way that they shift their emotional reaction after that. So we really are, when we get challenged with our actual understanding of things, it actually can maybe help us go against that emotional reaction. But it's also important to remember that we actually don't know as much as we think we know. And that's just generally true. And I know you're all a very intellectual library crowd, and that's probably hard to hear.
Well, just even that, there's a study on asking people, like, do you understand how a toilet works? Do you understand how a zipper works? And generally people say, like, yeah, I understand that. But as soon as you say, okay, write it down and explain it to me, I have no idea how a zipper works suddenly.
Wait, a zipper?
Yeah, that was the example in the study, yeah. And it is. Do you want to go for it? No, I don't want to put you on the spot.
Well, I mean, aren't there just interlocking? Like, isn't it kind of self-explanatory? You have these little things, and they just interlock.
But then they ask you to explain how you actually put it in at the beginning, like what exactly happens in that contraption. I don't want to put you on the spot. Yeah, yeah. But we were thinking about doing a video of asking those two questions on the street, because the study uses zippers and toilets. And and you watch people panic, and they don't.
People rate their own belief of their understanding before and then after,
right.
And once being challenged, say like, okay, maybe I'm not so sure anymore.
Yeah. Okay, so I need to ask you guys this because you guys are obviously YouTube stars.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
Right here on stage. Is social media making everything worse?
Well, I mean, we wouldn't exist without it, so...
I think...
It's a nuanced answer. I'll start with that, but
okay.
Keep going.
Yeah, I think that, like, any new technology as it comes about in our society can be seen for better or for worse. And I think that, you know, we've had entertainment for years that have, like, in the form of books. Like, people criticized movies and things because they weren't as good as plays for a long time, and understanding, like, the value of something isn't always so easy. And, you know, platforms like YouTube and Twitter and Facebook are really so young when you think of, like, the history of everything that we've created on Earth, as well as, like, our recent history of the past 100 years. So I think...
Or the universe, 13.8 billion years.
Yeah. Ages. I just think that's a really hard question. I think it's better asked as, like, it's not so black and white. There's great things and there's bad things, and I think if we can educate ourselves on what those negatives are, about how these apps in my phone are literally designed to capture my attention as long as they can, then we can understand how I get value from it and how I mitigate, like, the bad parts of it.
Okay, so go ahead.
No, okay, go.
Because there are two aspects to that. One is the algorithm itself, in that, let's say you're a parent looking at vaccine schedules, like when your kid should get vaccinated when, and then all of the suggested videos for you next will be about how vaccines are the worst thing in the entire world and are literal poison. So, I mean, how do you, as a regular person who may not necessarily be media savvy, if you're being inundated with all sorts of false information that does exist, how do you go about sort of, scientifically pushing back against that? And are we hardwired to not do that? Are we hardwired to accept what's the easy information sort of in front of us?
Yes. So we are definitely hardwired to accept what is the easy information, what is the emotional information. That is something that biologically we are going to be fighting against. And I think a little more opinionated maybe of an answer than you is, I think social media taps into that quite easily. I think what it does is it allows you to have quicker, faster information, and you're going to react more emotionally to something that I think is simpler for you and also fits with your cognitive already. We were talking about something you already believe in. But when it comes to, I heard you saying earlier about the algorithm talk coming up, and I think that algorithms is a really important aspect of all of this. And I think us working on YouTube and working closely with a company that is controlled by an algorithm is something that we are well aware of. And I think it is something, I think what you're trying to say is that it's hard to say whether it's good or bad right now, but it's definitely new. And I think it's definitely important that we are all here talking about it and assessing it all the time, how they're working, why they're working the way they are, so that we can help push these companies, which are controlled financially to make money, how can we make sure that they're also making sure our society is just? And I think that we are at a time where that's not necessarily, it's not daisies and sunshiny days, you know what I mean? We can't just accept that these things are going to be good and are going to be beneficial to society. So it's not that I'm saying that they're necessarily bad, but I definitely am not saying that they're good. And I think it's important that as citizens alive, what, a short period of time, I'm going through a little bit of a like death anxiety right now. I'm like, oh, what happens when you die? I'm freaking out. I'm like, I'm alive for such a short period of time. Anyways, we are alive for a short period of time, and it is important that we are challenging and figuring out how we make sure that these work properly for society moving forward after our lives. There's a lot of power in these companies. So that's what I would say.
We talked a little bit about confirmation bias, cognitive dissonance. What does it take scientifically, like I'm talking like brain-wise, to try and change somebody's mind? Because that's actually quite difficult. It's not as easy as, let's use the anti-vaxxer as an example, right? It's not as easy as, you know, presenting them with peer-reviewed study upon peer-reviewed study to say that actually, no, you know, vaccines are good for you and they, you know, have eliminated and eradicated so many diseases. Mm-hmm. How do you go about having that conversation? Because I think that the tired trope is like, at the Thanksgiving table, or you know, at Uncle Lenny going off again with his conspiracy theories.
My Uncle Lenny is the worst. I'm kidding.
How do you actually do that?
So we have a video on this. So go.
To a degree, I was gonna say like the first thing that most researchers found is that facts don't change people's opinions.
Which is so sad to say in a library. I'm sorry.
So like the whole like my feelings don't care about your facts is actually true.
Is my facts don't care about your feelings?
I mean,
people like to pretend that facts are the be-all and end-all. And obviously, as scientists and people who care about the truth, we're all trying to find and reiterate what we believe and study it.
But it's also where we see how hard it is for science to be communicated properly. Like, we live it all the time.
And what most of those studies that look at facts find is that it's actually the emotional side of things that tends to convey things to people that they tend to hold on to, and then they'll find facts that will support their beliefs. So, I mean, it's obviously a huge question that we don't have the answer to, but
the in-group, out-group is something that we, like, studied a lot when we were trying to make this video, and in regards actually to anti-vaxxers, which, according to science, are not supposed to say anti-vaxxers.
Oh, sorry.
You're supposed to say vaccine hesitant for the exact reason that it creates an emotional reaction when you say anti-vaxxer, yeah. You're supposed to say vaccine hesitant. Okay. Anyways, don't say the anti-vaxxer, but I know I do. I like to call them baby killers. I'm just kidding. I don't. I never do that. but yeah, so essentially what they use, they are studying this because they have to try and figure out how do we communicate this properly when it comes to vaccines. And the best thing to do is to try and talk to people and bring them into your in-group. So what you do is you, instead of first sort of getting mad, you would say, you know, we are obviously talking about the health of kids. Right. So let me start to talk to you about what actually happens when you have polio, how awful that is. And you're actually kind of getting emotional reactions from them because obviously they're scared for their kids. And that's how you're supposed to get the scientific information in then. But that's
even
hard. That.
There's the level of making sure that you can relate as humans. Before any science comes in, you say, like, can we all agree that we all just care about the health of children? Like, this is how it turns from you're an other to, like, okay, I can see you in my group now, because ultimately we're all trying to help.
Yeah,
kids,
it's very unlikely
survive.
Somebody's going to go, I'm anti-baby.
Exactly. So you find, because communities and people have a desire and an absolute necessity to be part of groups to survive. So it's so natural for us to form groups and beliefs around groups and look at other people and say, it's really easy to call you wrong because of XYZ reason, whether that's like something to do with gender or race or just ideals or countries. And so always thinking about a way that you can first appeal to somebody's inner group is like kind of the first mechanism of defense. So you can be on the same level and see each other as people, and not just to like manipulate someone else, but to actually for you to also see them as a person too and understand they're not crazy. They don't want to kill babies. They also are trying to take care of their kids in the best way they know possible. So that's just kind of that start, and it opens up a dialogue, I think, for people to actually listen, which is the hardest part.
And I think it's obviously, we know it is hard because you have to, that requires a lot of restraint from a person who maybe understands the science of something. And I think that's why when you, even when we were making that video and reading these studies, it was challenging to read them because it was going against what we even thought. We'd made a video about anti-vaxxers that was literally kind of tongue-in-cheek and funny, and it did really well, but then we realized this is definitely for people who already believe what we believe.
And are just kind of sharing it to
they're sharing it to ha-ha and laugh, and then we were like, oh my god, wow, if we had done this video before, we would have maybe changed our approach. And so, yeah.
So now it's obviously a lot easier to talk about something that is, you know, scientific in nature, like vaccines, like climate change, where there is a, you know, a bevy of peer-reviewed science. It gets a little bit dicier when we're talking about politics, particularly in an election campaign. So I think everybody saw that meme that that Natalie had put up about Trudeau, Castro's, you know, he's Castro's son. If you see somebody sharing that, what do you actually, how do you appeal to them in terms of that in-group sort of narrative or conversation?
I would say, like, what the challenge there is that in many ways social media can be a very limited way to have a real conversation. So obviously, yeah, like, that becomes a challenge. Like something like Twitter, where you can only share X amount of characters, how are you going to have a real conversation and have somebody's guard down enough to actually listen and not just think that you're a troll who's just trying to make them look stupid or whatever. So I've never, it's hard because your instinct or my instinct would to instantly be angry that someone's sharing that and try and tell them exactly how they're wrong. So how do you open the door for them to actually listen and understand that we all care about the same things? I don't know that I have a good answer.
Well, I mean, I don't know if we're going to, like, we shouldn't have necessarily answers on this subject fully. You know what I mean? Like, it's very complex. But yeah, I think that maybe is where you're starting to get at how social media and the world that we're living technologically is a really big challenge for that exact reason. How can you create an in-group when you can't even have like very thorough, nuanced conversations with people online that easily?
Well, and I mean, and part of that is part of that because social media in and of itself sort of filters out you into your own bubbles as it is. So you're only seeing the same sort of information that you already want to see. And then when, you know, somebody that you were peripherally friends with, let's say from like grade school or high school or something, shares this meme of Trudeau being Castro's son, how do you even like begin to sort of engage? You know what I mean? Like it gets very awkward as well.
No, that's true. And that is something that, again, is a reckoning that needs to happen with social media. It's going to continue to give you information and assert your cognitive bias that you already believe in. So it's going to, like you're kind of saying, it's going to become harder and harder for you to then relate to the other side if it's not being mixed in.
Yeah, and I just feel like we get like entrenched, right?
Yeah.
I think it's just like, it's a really important conversation to have at large as societies from a governmental perspective and also like from the industry and companies to acknowledge that these issues exist. Like the same reason that the internet is beautiful is that it allowed small communities to find each other, but it also might have led to people who believe like certain conspiracy theories to realize like, hey, all these other people believe it and it must be true if they all think it. Now I don't feel so like I'm the only one. So there is like a reckoning that sort of has to happen, I think, in a self-reflection of all of us to understand and stop and say like, I actually might be part of the problem. I'm sure I've on a whim just retweeted something that suited my beliefs without really challenging that. And if we don't actually question that, and if even platforms don't question that, it will just create an environment where like none of us are happy to be living in, I don't think, right?
It's very bleak.
Well, yes, well, I think yeah. Even like not that this is like tangentially related, but
life's bleak. You didn't know
yeah,
that.
Life's kind of bleak. But I was thinking about how like Instagram recently decided to take likes off of their posts, right? Obviously, there's many different theories, and I don't think they ever officially talked about. But some things I've heard people talk about is that, you know, everyone was realizing what kind of photos would do really well. So you'd always take a photo from this angle with this lighting and look good, and it was a lot of different selfies. But that created a platform that was really homogenous and not that interesting and didn't really stir up dialogue, didn't really give value to anyone. So I think from a platform perspective, the same thing will happen if we start to go to online spaces and all we find is, like, groups that cause stark division and hate and problems, and it's not going to be an enjoyable place for us to be at. So not only from a level of society do I think we need to think about it, but also I think it's in companies' best interest to make platforms be a positive experience that are conducive for the benefit of society.
I'm getting a hand signal from Jorge, okay. Which means... Oh, let's keep... Oh, five more minutes. Oh, the wrong hand signal. Okay, so good. Now I've got 5 minutes, and I want to ask you this question because I've seen this posited by multiple people who don't necessarily have much, you know, they didn't like research it or anything. It's just kind of like anecdotally or anecdata, and that is, people will willingly share fake news even if you know it's sort of fake because you do get that little dopamine rush or whatever it is that makes you feel as though you're, you know, king of the world for that like 2 seconds that you press that share button.
That sounds like a troll. Okay. Right? That's kind of your, well, it's true. Like if you are craving an emotional reaction from people, whether it's anger, it's still an emotional reaction, and there is still a dopamine rush, and there is still neurologically, it's something that is making you feel something. And if that's something that you want, you will get it from that.
So we're basically all just like rats in a maze hitting that food pellet.
Yeah, but I think that is a choice that someone makes to get that. I think a lot of people can get, you can get dopamine rushes from another amazing food, a beautiful new restaurant, an amazing song. Like you can get it in other ways, but it's not saying denying that you can also have negative.
Well, I'll also add though, like, because you're right that probably many people who aren't trying to screw over the world or spread fake news might retweet something or do something and share something even though they know it's kind of fake.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Trudeau meme thing is a really good example, right? Like, do people actually legitimately think? I think the vast majority of people who share that meme don't legitimately think that he's actually Castro's son, but they dislike his politics,
yeah,
or they, you know, his hair pisses them off. So it's like, yeah, I'm going to share that anyway.
But what I would say is, like,
a troll.
The brain gets these rewards. I think we're kind of seeing a little bit of a backlash to some social media because people are burnt out. Because you can feed into that, but just like an addiction to anything else, eventually your brain needs it more and more and more to get that same thrill out of it. So I think it's a slippery slope that we're all going to start feeling that sort of like negative impact.
Technological minimalism. Everyone's talking. Young people are talking about
really?
It because it's a hard life to live. We're realizing that we're addicted and that we're not happy necessarily.
So going back to your flip phone?
Hell yeah! Smart authors do that.
We have platforms that are helping us understand now, like digital well-being. Like we can see, okay, it's going to lay out for me and it can block me off this app after this amount of time. That will create a much healthier relationship for us and a much happier world, I think.
And we do need to be talking about this, like thinking about climate change, which is such a huge existential issue that we are trying to figure out how to talk about. It is so challenging. And one of the things that it's really hard to grapple with because we all want to do things in our day-to-day life, and it's important that we take it on firsthand and minimize turning our lights off, driving less. Like, this is all really important, but it does come down to action, groups of people getting together and ensuring that we don't take it from companies and we don't take it from governments. They're the people who have the power to actually make a change. So in similar ways with this, it is going to be about young people maybe having to be like, no, we're going to stop using our phone as much and you are going to make less money and that's how we're going to make a change. So I think that's why we're trying to say it's important that we don't. There was definitely a time where social media, and we've lived through it, I think at the age that we are at 30, where we didn't have the internet that we did. We were like, the internet is going to solve everything. We are going to get together. You know, we had such positivity around it. And how long ago was that? Like 8 years ago? And now I'm like, I can't believe that we're here. And that's why we need to keep talking about it so we can make sure that we realize it's not doing what we thought it was going to do. And it's up to us as consumers and as people living in it to actually make a change. And we have to have hope that we can do it with climate change and with, I think, something like this.
So basically to stand up to the man.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. It's not, hello, history, yeah. Right? Isn't that always what you need to do?
Apparently.
Right? Yeah. I was like, are you convinced? I don't know. Yeah.